one of Dan Marcus's Wax Museum features a very special guest, and this guy is so cool. Dean Torrance of Jan and Dean, welcome to the show, and thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Dan. It's my pleasure. Sitting here in Surf City, I'm a very lucky dude.
Obviously,
happy anybody wants to talk to you, you know?
Oh, that's not true. You are legendary. And I say that for a number of different reasons. First of all, you say Jan and Dean. Everybody knows who Jan and Dean is. They know your hits. They know Surf City was your biggest hit, that you were idolized by this garage band out of California called the Beach Boys, who modeled themselves after you.
Yeah.
I mean, you had hits before the Beach Boys were popular, going back to your days with Jan Barry, when you were doing doo-wop, is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, doo-wop was the inspirator of almost everything we ever did.
And Jenny Lee was your first big hit, which is not as well known as your other hits, but it certainly has an interesting history.
Well, it's the top 10 record, but
okay.
It's one of those that just didn't get that much recognition just because it was so primitive. It's a nice way of putting it.
Well, you recorded it in your garage, and it became a hit.
Okay, primitive is, but that's all relative. Because Jan had a three-car garage, so we were a three-car garage band, and the garage was in Bel Air. So,
okay.
Relatively speaking, it's not your typical garage or typical garage band.
Yeah, but
most of our equipment that we used was given to Jan's dad by Howard Hughes. How about that?
Really? Huh. Never knew that.
Jan's dad was a very brilliant engineer, and not recording engineer. And
as in building aircraft, designing aircraft type of engineer, you mean?
Yes, that's
okay.
What Howard Hughes was into.
Right.
And Jan's dad, Bill Berry, helped to design the Spruce Goose.
No, really?
That very famous airplane that did fly.
It did fly
once.
Didn't
go very far.
Yeah.
Didn't go very far, but it got up off the ground, which meant it could fly, and then they kind of put it, like a seaplane. And then they put it back down in the water and proved that it could fly.
And then immediately put it in a museum. It was the largest airplane of its time.
And Jan's dad also helped put that in the museum because I guess they had to deconstruct part of it to get it into the museum.
Interesting.
Which was in Long Beach, kind of right by the Queen Mary for many, 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 many years. Then some dude from, off the top of my head, I think it's Oregon or Washington, but I think it's Oregon. Some guy bought it that lived in Oregon, and then Jan's dad came out of retirement to help deconstruct the plane because then it was put on a barge and actually shipped up by ocean. Up to Oregon.
Wow.
Haven't seen it since, but it's up there somewhere.
Well, Jan...
Great plane.
Jan's... we got to get talking about Jan and Dean, or we could be here all day with the stories you have to tell, Dean. But is it safe for me to say that Jan Barry was the driven one of the two of you? He had a desire? He had a drive?
Oh, hell yeah. He was the alpha dog.
Okay. And you were...
He was extremely bright, and he came from Bel Air home, and so he had the money, or his family had the money, to be able to put together all of the things that we needed that most kids wouldn't be able to afford. So all the recording equipment, and he had his own musical room that was a converted garage. His dad. To his dad's credit, his dad realized that this was Jan's passion, and they were just happy that he had a passion of something. Like all parents do, they hope that their kids get some sort of passion and enjoy accomplishing something.
Yeah.
So his dad, you know, allowed him and helped him create this music room that was kind of all his.
Now, I'm thinking that there were a lot of kids in high school in your class that enjoyed singing and goofing around in the recording studio and everything. How come it was Dean Torrence? How come it was you that ended up partnering with Jan?
Well, we started out as a boys band. That's what, I guess that's what they call them today.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of guys that enjoyed, as you point out, a bunch of guys that enjoyed, and the music of the day in the 50s, of course, was for the young people, was a whole lot of doo-wop.
Right.
The little bit older group, you know, the 20-year-olds, they were more jazz.
Oh,
and folk music,
yeah.
You know, not this teenage music. But we liked the teenage music, and that's what we cared about. So the group of guys that would show up at Jan's studio, if you will, music room,
right,
after school, probably the core group was maybe 7 or 8 guys, and sometimes it was 10 or 12.
Okay.
And it just depended on who had a after school job or who didn't. And it was kind of loose. We'd just go up there and jam.
Yeah.
And because he had these tape recorders that were provided through Howard Hughes, because I guess Howard had upgraded all of his music equipment, and so he knew that Bill Berry had a son who was interested in music, blah, blah, blah. So
you recorded on Howard Hughes's discarded music equipment, recording equipment.
Yes.
I'll be.
And we recorded 2 top 10 records on those machines.
Jenny Lee and Baby Talk, right?
Yep. Uh-huh. And then did the whole Baby Talk LP. Also, most all of that was recorded in the garage, too, as well.
Who did the backing tracks?
Well, they're good for you. So you being a professional would be looking at, you know, to realizing that you did need backing tracks.
Right.
We would do the vocals, and Jan was proficient enough on keyboard and actually piano to be able to play the piano so we could all stay in tune. And then we had a couple of different microphones, and we just gather around the microphones and sing along as he played the piano and sang at the same time, because we didn't have separate tracks.
Right.
So basically we would create a track with a bunch of vocals on it and a lead vocal and kind of a piano reference track.
Right.
You can kind of hear the piano. And then that was taken into the studio, and then you actually hired studio musicians. They'd put on earphones, listen to the vocal track, and attempt, I say attempt in quotes, to play along with it.
I'll be. That's
now,
the exact opposite. Right? It's usually done the opposite way, right?
Totally backwards.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the musicians particularly liked it. It was harder for them because they were more conscious of tempo. You know, I mean, they were really musician types, so their tempo was spot on, where a bunch of teenagers, you know, banging on a piano and singing, and we didn't use a metronome or anything, so our meter was a little off.
Okay.
And these guys would really struggle. I didn't know the difference. It didn't sound like it should be that different, but they would struggle with it. They'd kind of snicker. They're getting paid for it, so they didn't really care, but it made their job a little bit harder.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Jenny
Lee.
Yeah,
you're right. For at least 2 years, that's the way we did most all of our records.
That's remarkable. Jenny Lee, Baby Talk, then came Heart and Soul. And by 1963, according to my records, that's when Linda came out. And that was a big hit for you and kind of established the Jan and Dean sound that was to follow with your falsetto.
Yeah.
You're the one with the falsetto in the band.
Right, so it was still doo-wop-y, but a falsetto lead had not, you know, there was, those were few and far between, but I think we had heard the Four Seasons.
Four Seasons.
By then.
Yeah, that would have been a year earlier.
So, yep. Yeah, so we said, that was pretty cool, you know, and we could do that. Now that we are not any longer trying to record out of the garage.
Right.
Now that we're in the studio, now we can multi-track stuff.
Wow.
We all, again, our roots were all in vocals, and
sure.
we loved four-part harmonies plus a falsetto plus a bass part, and, you know, we wanted to be like Four Seasons or Dionne and the Belmonts. We wanted to be in a group.
Well, yeah, so you
were to be in a group with two guys.
Your garage band, you know, was, I mean, 10 or 12 people, and now all of a sudden it's just the two of you, so yeah, you're going to multi-track your vocals.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It just, you know, the 10 or 12 people just kept breaking down. Guys would get busy with after-school jobs. Or what really breaks up the band, and you can also follow that same thought with the Beatles, if you know what I mean,
yeah,
is girlfriends.
Girls, yes. So yep.
Girls would all of a sudden be in the mix, and Jan, being a chick magnet, they didn't want their guy or new guy to be hanging out with Jan because they knew of, you know, all the other girls that would be hanging around because it was Jan.
Good looking so, guy, lots of money in the family. Yeah. What's not to like?
What's not to like? So a new girlfriend would, you know, you're going through puberty and stuff, and when the girlfriend says, I don't want you to go up and sing those stupid songs with those guys, you know, we're going to go to a movie, and you know, so, if you're kind of horny enough, you go, okay, I'm going to go to the movie, you know.
So it became Jan and just Dean almost by default.
Yeah, we didn't want it that way. We preferred to be in a vocal band with lots of harmonies.
Okay.
Well, now we're in the probably 1962-ish, late 62, and we do Linda, and we realize, hey, we can sing all those parts now ourselves.
And split the money two ways instead of 12.
Yeah, because Jan being the... Jan was pretty much straight-A student when he cared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very bright guy, and he would go, so Dean, you know, I mean, we do miss the other vocals, right? And I said, yeah, I wish Wally were still here, and Billy, and all the rest of those guys. And he said, but, okay, here's a picture of a pie. Now, if we still had those five or six or seven guys, here's what would happen. This pie gets cut up all this way. Oh, I see. Now,
yep.
Now this just, it has de-evolved down to two of us. We're now a duo. We don't particularly want to be a duo, but the other guys stopped showing up.
Yeah.
Because even their parents were saying, what are you wasting your time going up and doing that kind of stupid stuff?
They didn't see the future of it.
Here's the pie. Now, it's just you and me, right? I was going, okay. Here's the cut, just right down the middle. Do you notice the size of the pieces? Okay. So now you can go into the recording studio. We can still be in a vocal band because we can start stacking vocal parts ourselves and enjoying the process of singing harmonies.
Yeah.
We were not great lead singers, but we could pull it off well enough.
Was there any concern in the studio, Dean, that you wouldn't be able to replicate the sound of the record on stage?
No, we never even thought of that.
No?
I mean, that was acceptable in the days, and especially still the early 60s. You were still lip syncing a lot
on American Bandstand or Soupy Sales Show or whatever,
or even the record, in quotes, record hops all the DJs would have kind of on the weekends.
Yep.
That's how they made their extra money on weekends.
Yep.
Where they have a record hop. Well, you'd show up and they would have a turntable. They'd throw your single on and you just lip sync to the single, and they'd turn it over, and you'd sing the B-side, and then if you had another single, an old single, they'd play that. You'd lip-sync. maybe three songs, four, and then you'd leave the stage, and he would have the next artist that showed up lip-sync some stuff, or if there wasn't an artist there yet, they would just keep spinning the records, and kids would dance. So it's pretty easy. So you didn't really have to worry about singing live.
And the kids didn't seem to mind at all?
No, hell no.
Okay. Cool.
Well, I mean, look at the Beatles playing live at a stadium.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you see some of those early on pictures, like mid-60s, and there's no monitors. How the hell were you able to pull off something? But, you know, audiences weren't all that sophisticated. They didn't really care as long as you showed up, and they screamed so loud. It didn't really make any difference whether or not. I can't imagine that sitting in the audience, you heard very much.
Oh, so but we're talking
the group
about
was there. You heard them on the radio, so you already knew what they sounded like.
So with that in mind, lip syncing at personal appearances, keeping that in mind, I'm going to fast forward a little bit to October of 1964 and the Tammy Show.
Oh, no, not October. God. Okay, what happened then?
The Tammy Show, October of 64.
Oh, Tammy. That was 64. Okay.
Yeah, and because I remember it was just a few months. I looked it up. I did the research. And it was just a few months after the Beatles had hit. And here are all these amazing American bands and artists, and they're singing live. And I mentioned it to you because not only were you in the show and singing parts, you and Jan hosted the dang thing.
Yeah, well, I think we were just about, well, besides the Beach Boys, we were kind of the only local guys. Even the Beach Boys would have to drive an hour to get there, an hour and a half.
Okay.
We literally lived within 15 minutes of the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium. So
it was a matter of geography that chose you and Jan to be the host?
They didn't have to pay us, you know, and put us up in a hotel.
Oh, no. So, tell me you got paid.
I don't know.
You got paid something. You had to.
Oh, well, I'm saying, we got paid. But, I mean, they didn't have to dish out extra money to put us up because we lived there.
Okay, gotcha.
And so it was convenient for us to be involved in the production, getting the production all put together because the other acts were out working and we were going to school 5 days a week. So we were always in town. So we weren't gone, which made it easier to deal with us. And of course, we put together the house band, and the house band was all the guys that cut our records.
Did you work with the Wrecking Crew?
The studio guys, the Wrecking. It was pretty much the Wrecking Crew.
Okay,
it was Hal and all those guys were. And I just saw a special on Leon Russell.
Yes,
I don't know how I saw that.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent it to me. Leon was one of our keyboard players.
Wow.
So he. In that band, at the Tammy Show, there's a guy with, you know, sitting at a piano with a pompadour, you know, looking totally different than what he ended up looking like.
Yeah.
And that's Leon Russell. And they played, I remember watching him play on the Supremes on their set. And you know, he was just perfect. And all those guys were such great musicians.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for the most part, they played on all of our records, played on all the Beach Boy records, and probably played on at least half of the other people that were on that show.
Yeah, well, it was an amazing lineup for the Tammy Show. And James Brown, Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones said that the biggest career mistake that the Rolling Stones ever made was following James Brown on the Tammy Show.
Yeah, that wasn't too smart. Because it sounded pretty basic.
Okay.
Because the Stones were still kind of, really had kind of a primitive sound.
Yeah.
They didn't have any real vocal parts. You just had a lead singer.
Right.
And then James Brown, of course, he had the whole Wrecking Crew, plus his own band with their horn section and all that. So it was a huge sound, and then after he did what he did and what he does live, and to have to come out and follow that with, you know, four guys or five guys, whatever it was at the time, was pretty minimalist. You know, but it worked.
But it worked, and it was still, it was the Stones, for crying out loud, with Brian Jones intact. One of the dancers I found out a few years ago was Terry Garr.
Right.
Tell me you met Terry Garr.
We didn't really meet people.
Okay.
That's what happens when you're the host.
Okay.
So we weren't sitting around like everybody else was backstage and had different dressing rooms, and they'd cruise in and out of each other's dressing rooms and and hang, and you know, when there was a downtime, they just got to hang out with one another.
And of course Terry wasn't a big name actress at that point.
No, but if, you know, of course we were all looking at the dancers. They were cute little things.
Sure.
So, you know, I remember being a little bit more interested in the dancers than I was meeting the Stones.
Tony Basil was one of the dancers.
Yes.
Wow. Okay, well, I just had to know if I was one degree removed from Terry Garr or not. So.
Well, yes, you wonder. Maybe 1.5 degrees.
Okay, that's fair. Let's get back to the music for a second. Linda, you told me a story and dispelled a myth for me, and I'd like you to do that again for everybody listening.
I'm sorry.
Dan Marcus Wax Museum. And that is that Linda, the song is not about Linda Eastman, but she is involved in a peripheral way with the song, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's close enough. I mean, it's still interesting.
Because the story always went around that Linda Eastman, who later became Paul McCartney's wife, was the Linda of that great 40s ballad, and then you updated it in 1963, and it was a top 40 hit, but it wasn't really about Linda Eastman, Paul McCartney's future wife.
No.
So we'll, you no, can tell the story.
As I explained to you, and you were the only one to know about this for a while.
Yeah.
Until you blabbed it, you know, to others later.
Yeah. Well, I put it on the radio for crying out loud, Dean, yeah.
Yeah, yes, you did. You blew the whole, you know, whole story.
Sorry.
Now you did say that other version came out in 1953, is that it?
I think it was written in the 40s, and there have been three or four different versions of the song through the late 40s, early 50s, because Linda would have been born about 1942 or so, something like that.
Yeah, I guess you're right. So the song was written early on, and the guy that wrote it, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, but
was it Jack Lawrence comes to mind? Does that sound right?
Oh, Jack Lawrence sounds right. Yes.
Okay.
Jack Lawrence, great songwriter, of course, that we all remember. Jack Lawrence,
tongue in cheek.
He wrote, you know, in the day, a songwriter, you know, did pretty well. If you wrote a hit song, you obviously got paid for the hit song. Plus, you also did sheet music, and sheet music would be a good income stream to us as well.
For the writer, especially, anyway, yeah.
So the guy writes the song, and the song is about an old girlfriend, obviously named Linda. So they had broken up, and he was heartsick, you know. He should have been a country writer, talking about heartbreak and all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So anyway, he figures, you know, if I write a hit song and impress her, she'll come back to me, right?
Right.
So, you know, a lot of artists. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Heartbreak is good inspiration.
You wrote the song, it comes out, some artist sings it, but to accompany the recording, then you did have, in quotes, sheet music that would come out, and then people could, it would have a chord chart in there, and so somebody that could play the piano would sit at the piano and learn the song. So sheet music was a big deal. So this poor guy, Jack, did you say? Jack.
I think it was Jack Lawrence. I don't hold me to that, but I'm pretty sure. Sounds right.
It's close enough.
Okay.
So Jack, and anybody that decides to look that up, you have way too much time in your hands. So that's my personal opinion.
That's fair. Okay.
Okay, Thank you. I mean, you must know those nerds, right?
I am one, probably.
Okay.
I qualify.
You said it.
Yeah, well, you thought it first, though.
We need people like you. Well, thank God for people like you.
Yes, you know, I've made a living all these decades being a music nerd.
So anyway, poor Jack, you know, poor Jack. So he writes the song. It's somewhat of a hit, and you know, he calls up the gal, or I don't even know if she had a phone. You know, he's looking at a phone,
yeah.
Or he writes her something. Anyway, contacts Linda, and then you know says, and, you know, obviously you heard it on the radio and all this, and she's again, well, and he said, I really would love to have you come to a studio, a photography studio, and I'd love you to be, since it's written about you, that you be on the sheet music, on the cover.
Okay.
The sheet music.
Yeah.
She said, yeah, don't call me anymore, and hung up on him.
Oh. Okay.
That's such a sad story. I mean, it's just a sad story.
You're right. This is a country song all the way.
He went through all this work, and he got just hung up on. So he's moaning and crying and is beside himself, because that's the only reason he wrote this damn song, was to get this girl back, and it didn't work.
She
didn't want to be on the sheet music, and God, what girl wouldn't want to be on sheet music? I mean,
well, come on.
The poor guy was a mess.
Right.
So the publishing company guys are all sitting in their office going, oh, what, you know, what do we put on the cover of the sheet music? And, you know, they probably had a board meeting or something. And the lawyer, you know, they all have to have a lawyer.
Yeah.
So the lawyer, and his last name was Eastman. Eastman. I forgot his first name.
Oh.
Might have been John.
Okay.
Anyway, the lawyer says, well, you know, I got an idea. He said, I just had a daughter born, just, you know, a couple of 6 months ago or 8 months ago, a year ago, or whatever it was.
She was
and
that young. Huh.
Her name is Linda. So there you go. And that's nice tie-in. See, it's all conceptual. You're not lying or anything. It's yeah. It's a Linda.
Yeah.
It's kind of cute. They also knew that Linda was, well, we would have known this, but I don't know if poor Jack knew about it. Probably not. But Linda was one of the most popular names in the, like, the 50s,
yeah.
40s, and 50s.
Yeah.
So, you know, so it was a good name, good marketing name, and everybody liked it, and there'd be Lindas and all sorts of families and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I guess the hierarchy thought, well, okay, Mr. Eastman, we'll put your daughter on this. And so she had her picture as a kid, you know, a very young kid, as I remember. She was on the sheet music.
Was she an infant at this point then?
I don't know that much detail. That's up to you to find that out. I don't have time.
Well,
but you do. Nerds have plenty of time to, you know, research all this kind of crap. I don't care. See?
Well,
I'm telling you the basic story, and who cares?
I have already looked it up, and it was a number one hit for Buddy Clark in 1947. Buddy Clark, 1947.
Okay, and so that kind of lines up that 47 would, yeah, she'd probably be, you know, 5 or 6 or something like that. I mean, you could look mm-hmm. up her age, too. And then calculate from there.
Okay.
You know,
what
age she was. Which you can do that. I don't have time.
That's fair. You got to hit the beach. I know.
Yeah, the sun's going down here, you know.
Yeah.
I got about 2 more hours of sun.
Yeah.
but anyway, so that's the basic story. So she was young. I don't think she was in diapers. Probably still a cute little kid at 4 or 5 or something like that, which would be nice. And the parents would get a kick out of seeing a young you know, a little young person named Linda on this thing and think that was pretty cute.
Well, having a song called Linda as a hit in 1963 and knowing Paul McCartney to be the musicologist, he may be the ultimate music nerd, to be honest. And I mean that in the kindest possible way. You met Paul and Linda at one point, did you not?
Yes.
And was there a discussion about Linda with Linda?
Oh, I know you remember this, and you're leading me right into it, aren't you? That's why you're a broadcaster, and I'm not.
That's why I recorded you on audio tape all those years ago, so that I go back and review.
Yes, I know. Yeah. Very good. I'll let your audience know that you already know the answer to this.
Okay.
Yes, I was at... normally, if I had more time, I'd make up something totally the opposite just to screw you up. But, I'm not going to do that.
But as busy as you are.
I thought of it, but man, it's not really kind. Yes, I just happened to be at I think it was Brian Wilson's birthday.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. And it was at Carl Wilson's house, and he had a beach house. And that beach house was just above Malibu, kind of in the Zuma area. And I was dating a girl that lived just a little bit north of Zuma Beach. And I invited this girlfriend who had, you know, she's fairly new for me.
Right.
And I invited her to this party right down the street, and I said, it's one of the Beach Boys. And I don't even know if she knew. I'm pretty sure she knew who the Beach Boys were. So she was, I don't know, she was kind of cool about it. You know, I mean, she was one of those. And so I said, but you enjoy yourself.
Okay.
It'll be interesting. So we drive to Carl's house, which was like a 7-minute drive.
Yeah.
And I'm coming down this road, and I'm trying to explain to her what it is she's about to get into, because she was not used to this kind of, you know, music thing or Hollywood thing. So I'm trying to, you know, it's hard to explain Brian, but I was doing my best.
Yeah.
So we're heading down this long road right by the beach, and I'm explaining Brian, and then I'm looking ahead, and about maybe 100 yards, 150 yards from me, and we're approaching it, I see some guy in a bathrobe standing out in the middle of the street.
In a bathrobe?
Yeah, it's not a busy street. It's like a little two-laner.
Okay.
Just a beach, a little beach neighborhood.
Okay.
And I said, and a matter of fact, I said, that's him, pointing down the road. In the bathrobe. So, well, he's even stranger than you're making it out to be. And then I noticed there's two cops on either side of him.
Oh.
I don't even know if I told you any of this part.
No.
There's two cops on either side of him. And I go, holy crap, what the? They're already arresting him? I mean, you can't arrest him on his birthday.
No, that's not fair.
I mean, that's not right, and who, you know, is a party going to break up? And I was worried this party was going to go away.
Yeah,
they took him away. So I get closer and closer, and I'm finally close enough to start to park. And I'm looking at one of the cops, and I go, that looks like John Belushi.
And the other cop was?
Yeah, that's Al, whatever his name is. On that show, you know, that show that's on at night on Saturdays.
That Saturday Night Live show.
It was Saturday Night Live. It was a bit that they did with Brian where they were arresting him for not surfing.
Yeah, I remembered that bit. That's classic.
Classic bit. Of course, I didn't know anything about that. I mean, I had no idea, you know, what was going on. But I was kind of used to showing up at stuff that you couldn't figure out. It would take you most of the night to figure out what was going on, and or maybe weeks later you kind of piece it all together.
Yeah,
and I, you know, it's a place to have free cake and booze and stuff, so I didn't really care. And then I realized there's cameras and stuff, so I figured it was some sort of bit. And then we must have said hello as we walked past. I don't remember. And going to Carl's house. And we were there about maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and, you know, I was introducing you to the people that I knew.
Yeah.
And then this guy that looks like a beetle starts walking towards me, and I went, guy looks just like a beetle. Or that could be that Keith Allison guy in Paul Revere and the Raiders.
Yes, looks right. A little bit, yeah.
You know?
Wow.
So I just wasn't sure, and he gets closer, I'm going, shit, that's Paul McCartney. He walks up, puts his hand out, and Linda's standing next to him. He said, I'm Paul. And I said, well, yeah, okay.
Right.
And this is Linda. And, you know, we certainly are fans of your music and love, you know, and he starts singing Linda.
Oh, man.
You know, the little part. And I got, oh, I said, hey, wow, you got a pretty good voice. You should probably see if you get in the business.
You did not.
Okay, maybe I didn't. I was thinking.
Okay.
I think I put him on by saying, oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite. I did. I think I said that. That's one of my favorite Beatles songs. He said, no, that's yours. He didn't know my humor. I said, oh, God, they all sound alike to me. And we chuckled about that.
Wow.
I introduced him to my date, who is Kathy McCarty.
Oh.
Without the end.
Okay.
I said, this is my girlfriend, Kathy McCarty. And she says, oh, Mick. You know, so they did their little talking about Irish and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
It was kind of cute.
Wow. So that's
then
wow.
He was in town to do a Wings thing at the L.A. Forum in a couple of days. So I said, oh, no, we're playing the Forum and the Wings group and, you know, love to have you come. I said, oh, it's Saturday, right? She said, yeah. I said, I'll let you know.
Wow.
I swear.
Oh, geez.
To this day, this is the only thing I regret out of all of it.
Yeah.
I didn't take him up on it.
Oh.
But I thought he was just being nice and that, you know, here's the number of the people that you call. You know, one of those things.
Right. But, wow, he
and
was serious.
We didn't have cell phones in those days, so I wouldn't know who I was talking to, and I just thought he was being nice.
Wow, wow. Great story,
though. I had a volleyball game that night, indoor, and it was a championship game. We were in this league, and I'm playing with a couple of guys that played on the Olympics, and it was a pretty neat deal.
But and still, you had to pass
it. See volleyball or go see Wings.
Yeah.
Volleyball. And
wow.
Volleyball.
Volleyball.
Then I dislocated my thumb in that game, and then I went, I should have gone to see Wings.
Wow. Yeah, you'd still have use of your thumb.
If I ever run into him again, I'm going to tell him I'm so sorry I didn't go. I should have gone. I'm a huge fan. And
he will remember this whole thing, I guarantee you.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so pissed off you didn't show up. I destroyed all of my Jan and Dean records.
Wow. You had a Jan and Dean vinyl burning party like they did the Beatles,
yeah,
10 years earlier.
At McCartney's house. Oh, God.
That's amazing.
And the Stones are probably there going, yeah, they didn't even talk to us at the Tammy show. They're snotty guys.
One of the things,
on all their records.
See, one of the things, and you've proven it with this interview, is one of the things about Jan and Dean as a group and you individually is that you get the joke. It's not just all serious music. There's a lot of tongue-in-cheek in your music, and there's a lot of entertainment, and very few groups injected that amount of thought and entertainment and fun into their songs. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, pretty much. And I got a great compliment from Frank Zappa, of all people.
Really?
And that was in, you know, in the late 60s by this time. And that Frank Zappa was one of the first guys to get it and know that it was, you know, it was really, what we were doing was very subversive, but it was really cool. Which I think is one of the reasons why we're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, is that we were subversive in some way, shape, or form. And I don't think the industry, particularly the industry guys, really didn't like it.
That,
we,
that you
that
were
we weren't soldiers, you know, we weren't soldiers of the whole music thing. We could care less.
You were just having
a good time. We kind of enjoyed a bunch of other things, you know?
Well, that's probably very valid. It's a shame you're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You should be.
Well, thanks, but it's too late. And I say that because Jan's not here. I mean, Jan would have loved, you know, before the accident, he probably wouldn't have cared. I mean, we went to some big billboard thing once where we got huge, some sort of big award and whatever it was. They gave us a plaque or trophy or something. We left it on the table when we left the place.
Really?
We didn't really care about it. That was before the accident. After the accident, Jan would have really loved, you know, having, you know, some sort of praise on, you know, what he did do, what he accomplished. And
deservedly so.
No kidding. Talking about being a pioneer, for God's sake, as we pointed out earlier.
Yeah.
Two top 10 records, you know, made in this guy's garage as a teenager.
Yeah.
Come on. How many other people have done that? Not very many. And then how many other groups actually, well, first of all, wrote most of their material.
True.
Okay, that cuts down to a bunch. I'd say only maybe a third of the people that are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame actually wrote their own material.
Yeah.
And then now that you're in the top third, then how many of those groups actually arranged all their own records? Well, that's down to maybe 5%.
But it's
how many produced, arranged, and wrote and sang their own stuff?
Yeah.
Very few.
Well, and you're absolutely right. That's the degree of talent that you exhibited, and you put it into every single song. Every song. I mean, and you're singing about stuff that's just built-in fun. Little old ladies with hopped-up cars and
yeah. I thought of it as visuals. I mean, see, because of my ADD, I think of visuals. I don't think of words, or I do somewhat, but
interesting.
I knew that a lot of the stuff in Dead Man's Curve and Ride Alone Surf, all that stuff, all had visuals attached to it. Because young people really in those days, like in the early 60s, mid 60s, media wise, they really weren't exactly sure what you were talking about, but they got the general idea. So you tried to create all of these extra visuals to go along with the music.
You mean like the lyric "Bust Your Bun"? Was that
Yeah, there's one right in there. I wrote that, by the way.
Did you?
Yeah.
And it got your song banned on the radio.
I don't know if you can say that, right?
No, you can't say "bust your buns."
Oh my God. Bust your buns are gonna hustle you.
Yeah.
Oh no, you can't say that.
Oh, that's right. They let "bust your buns" through, but they didn't allow "gonna hustle you." I got it backwards. You're right. Yeah.
Isn't that strange?
Yeah.
I actually had to ask my dad because I'm being told by adults that the adults is in quotes.
Grown-ups.
At the record company, that you couldn't say the word "hustle you" on the radio. Oh, my God.
Yeah. How silly was that? But then you rewrote the lyrics, and it becomes a hit anyway. And that's talent.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, that's true. But I always liked the original just because, Gonna Hustle You had all of those same kind of tongue-in-cheek, humorous stuff, and then when we wrote "New Girl in School," to me that was just too obvious. But
yeah,
we did it anyway.
There you go, being subversive, and you had no idea it'd keep you out of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, but that's okay by me.
Yeah,
and plus, so, you know, the Rock and Roll. Maybe I'd feel differently about it if it were in L.A. There's a nice building, and you could walk in there and look at your own stuff. But, you know, being in Cleveland, just don't care.
A little out of your way.
I'll tell you, those guys are very lucky that, unfortunately, Dick Clark had a stroke, because Dick was kind enough to give me an office at his Burbank building.
Oh.
Cute, nice, really cool old building. Because I was helping, I did a lot of his graphic work. I designed the American Music Awards logo.
Did you? Well, we got to get into that whole phase of your career. We haven't even touched the surface yet. Dean, I'm taking up a lot of your time here. But, yeah, you being a visual person, and I got to get it said before I forget, you've got a Grammy for album design.
Weird.
You know?
That's almost laughable.
No, it's not. That's cool.
It is cool. People say, Grammy Award winner, and then you don't. Little asterisks there, and you have to look at the asterisks down the bottom of the page. Graphic design.
You don't give yourself enough credit. You don't, because you had Kitty Hawk Productions turned out some great stuff, and you had what, 4 nominations and 1 win, a Grammy for an album cover.
Yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, and that was after you stopped making music because of Jan's accident. So you reinvented yourself, and you're still getting major awards and recognition. Wow.
It was pretty cool, I'll tell you.
And where is the Grammy now?
So that's a rhetorical question, right?
I know. I have the answer.
Yeah, okay.
You want me to pass on that? Do you want me to withdraw the question?
No, I don't care. Well, specifically, I don't even remember where it went. I kind of remember the general idea. The Grammy used to sit on, because it really was not, I hated the record cover that won, even though I designed it. I didn't think it should have been nominated. I didn't think it was that. I thought the concept was really good, but it wasn't good packaging of music.
Okay.
But again, the visual was interesting. But in my mind, we're supposed to be promoting the record artist.
And the name of the artist, let's put it on the record, the name of the artist was?
Pollution.
Pollution, right.
So it was a new group. They'd been working on their music for years. And then the record company wanted me to do this concept, and I did it for them. I thought it was a bad idea. And then when it won a Grammy, they said, "That was a bad idea. Remember you thought it was a bad idea?" And I said, "I still think it's a bad idea."
Yeah, wow. But it won.
I would have much rather gotten the Grammy for the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band stuff, because I thought that was a lot better.
Yep.
But, Pollution, it was a picture of a chicken, a real chicken. We didn't have Photoshop in those days.
Right.
So took a picture of a little chick coming out of an egg, but the chick has a gas mask on. Okay, that's clever.
Okay, and the name of the group is Pollution.
Well, it's Pollution. Yeah. So, you make the connection there, but you're making a political statement on a record cover or a cover of an LP of a new group, and they should be promoting their music, not some sort of political statement. And, that does the group no good. They don't get any exposure. Sometimes they would get exposure, artists would, at the very least, on the back of the package then sometimes, if that's where their picture would go, if it weren't on the front.
But
even on the back, we had the chicken again. So those poor people didn't get their picture on it. And the consumer, if in those days you would, most everybody went to a record store to get the package. So if they're thumbing through all the new releases and they come across a chicken, coming out of an egg with a gas mask on, they'd probably pick it up. They'd look at it and they'd go, I wonder what kind of music these people do.
Right.
And I think you'd probably guess country music, maybe, but then the gas mask, I don't know, maybe.
But
jazz.
Give it credit for being.
What the hell?
Eye-catching, and making people stop, pause, and think, and maybe pay more attention to this record label or album cover than to the next album in the bin.
And somebody else's, right.
Yeah.
Also in the bin. Because you're in the bin competing with hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of other albums. And the consumer, you always want 50 albums, right? You can maybe afford 2. at the very most.
Yeah.
And then you know, when you got paid or got some more money in a couple of weeks, you'd come back and hopefully get that other one that you wanted. But then by that time, there's another new product, and you're competing with that.
Yep. Yeah.
So you got to grab them pretty quickly. And
I think the album cover did. Certainly.
So the idea was the album cover. But you knew you wanted musically, you wanted, let's say, 10 different pieces of music. But you only had money for one, so how are you going to make that other choice?
Yeah.
You know, I like so-and-so's music, so-and-so's music, so-and-so. So you look at all the packages. Well, one's got a great picture of the person or persons that you're interested in, and oh my God, it says a sticker says there's a poster inside. Oh, well, I'm getting a lot more for my money for this LP than I am for my other ones that I want to get, which don't have as much to offer. So this is the package I'm going to buy on this visit to the record store. So that's all it was. Yeah, you can't sell a piece of crap, just because you have an interesting cover.
Yeah, but you might get some people
already want the music.
You got to hope that some of those stupid disc jockeys on the radio like the album cover enough to try it. But you can't trust their taste.
No, but even they can be. I did a Linda Ronstadt cover, and Linda wanted a picture of a pig on it. You know,
okay.
And I'm going, look. This cover is going to be, along with your new product, to the media, to the disc jockeys, the program director. Program director's going to go through. He's getting, on a Monday morning, he's got 25 or 50 new releases that he's got to go through.
Yep.
And, here's this Linda Ronstadt, and you're going to look at it, and there's a picture of a hog on it, and it's just not going to grab him. He'll just pick up the next one and look at. So, we need a picture of you because
much
it's
more
your
interesting
career that you're promoting. You're not promoting, a hog. You're promoting a Linda Ronstadt as an artist. And, we can still make it kind of funky and make it visually, pretty.
So which album cover was that you ended up designing for her?
I think it was called Linda Ronstadt.
Okay.
I don't think that had a title.
Okay. Just curious.
Early on, when our Capitol Records before she went on to something else. But anyway, so the packaging is for an entertainer who is building their brand.
Yeah.
This is your 12 by 12 surface that you have visually, a space to promote this artist visually. Because somebody already heard the music on the radio and already likes it. So now you're connecting the consumer with, here's the visual. And then you have the written word.
So it's not just picking up. It goes well beyond. The thought process goes well beyond just slapping a picture on an album cover.
Well beyond. Tom Hanks gave me a very nice compliment by saying he whenever he got a Jan Dean album, the first thing he did was read the liner notes.
Yeah.
Because he knew it was going to be interesting, it was going to be fun, and he was going to enjoy it because he got the humor and knew that there was going to be something interesting written to as well.
The liner notes for the anthology album were just off the wall great. I mean, that was pages. That was a book.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
Again, you have the opportunity to put a book in there, then do it and make it as interesting as you can.
It was.
You have all this space. Don't waste it.
Yep. That's very cool. Dean, listen, we've already gone over an hour, and I haven't even touched on half the songs I want to talk about. Can we do a part two sometime?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, this has been...
Well, in closing, you started to talk about the Grammy, and we never really finished that.
Yeah,
so with the Grammy.
Where is your physical Grammy?
I got this Grammy that I didn't really like. They misspelled my name.
Really? Oh, jeez. Yeah. One R instead of two?
No, they had the two R's, but it was an A-N-C-E instead of E-N-C-E, which I was kind of used to.
Bonehead move, though.
Got misprinted a lot, but nonetheless... And I really wasn't really proud of the cover anyway, so I had it. I kept it on the back of a toilet in my office bathroom.
Okay, at
home office. which most of this room is the second floor is like a playroom, and then a little office and my own little office and a bathroom.
Okay.
So my girls probably were like 12 or 13 and nine, well, been nine at the time, 9 and 13-ish in that range.
Yeah.
Okay. And they came up to the playroom, which they like to play soccer in and other stuff. But then they got the idea that they wanted to play Grammys, and that they would, and since there was an actual real Grammy right there on the toilet, we can go get it.
Oh no!
And then they practiced.
Really?
They were practicing doing their Grammy speeches. I wasn't there, so I just kind of heard about it.
Okay.
So they're practicing their thank you for the Grammy and thanking the record producer and the label and whoever else.
And the album cover designer. Yeah, I got it.
And the album cover designer and blah, blah, blah. And they were having so much fun with it. But then, and, you know, as kids do, and then they got tired of that and they were going to play soccer or something else. They set down the Grammy on the couch, and then they did something else. And somehow they came back to the couch, and they lost track of the Grammy, and they sat on it.
Oh.
One of them sat on it and broke it.
Oh. Oh.
In three places it was broken.
Oh, man, it's brutal.
And they panicked. They, you know, ran downstairs and told their mom. I was out of the house. Told the mom they were crying, and my wife said, you know, now calm down. I'm sure your dad's not going to be all that upset. Oh yes, he will. I kind of guarantee you. I don't think he will be, but you know, you need to tell him. Oh, they were scared to tell me.
So anyway, they had to break the news.
Yeah, they had to break the news when I got home. Of course, I got home and. We have something to tell you. You better sit down. Okay. I thought it was something, you know, really bad. And I guess the one that sat on it, you know, just explained what they were doing. And then he said, we sat on it and broke it. I started laughing. I was in tears. I could barely speak. The visual of that just was... Oh. I don't know if they handed it to me or I had to go upstairs and look. I don't remember. I thought it was the funniest thing that happened to me that whole day.
Well, you get Father of the Year for that.
Ah, thank you. And then I said, look, okay, it's fixable. And I went to the garage and I got some duct tape.
Duct tape.
Duct tape the thing together, and the horn was hanging. You know, it was hilarious.
Oh man!
And a friend of mine saw it and had to have it. So
really?
I said, okay, you can have it. And I think he said he'd buy me a new one if he could have that one. I said, okay, you can have it.
Wow!
I don't even remember who that was. He never did buy me another one either. So.
Jeez, some friend.
I'm Grammy-less.
Wow. But you got a great story to tell about it.
it's worth the story. I've told the story like 50 times now, probably.
Wow.
And it still makes me laugh.
Yeah, you had told me the story before, but not in so much detail. That is funny. Wow.
That is. I don't know if anybody else could tell quite that kind of a story about a Grammy, but...
Dean, there are so many questions I have yet to talk to you about and ask you about. Everything from, you know, we haven't even touched on Jan's car crash, and I know a lot of people wonder what happened there. Can we come back and do this in another couple of weeks and make another episode?
Sure.
Because,
we'll do part two.
Because I've thoroughly enjoyed our time together, and as I told you off the air, you're a great storyteller, and you've got great stories. So,
you ask good questions. Questions get good stories.
Well, you know? Thank you. I have 7 questions left to ask you, and I know you know about this. We'll end this particular episode with the 7 questions
I have ADD. You don't think I actually read them, do you?
Well, I'm going to read them to you now. And you've got 1 minute to give me your full answer to all 7 questions, okay?
Pressure. Now, this is big-time pressure.
This first thing that comes to your mind kind of thing, okay, Dean?
Okay.
Here come the 7 questions, and we'll start the timer. You got 1 minute, 7 questions. First question, least favorite high school class?
I didn't really like hardly any of them.
Okay.
Except print shop.
Print shop. Second question. Yeah. Car you learned to drive in.
1951 Ford.
Favorite board game.
Have to be still Monopoly.
Favorite movie.
It's a mad world.
Or
Holy Grail.
Favorite guilty pleasure.
That's every day. chocolate.
Where did your first boy-girl kiss take place?
Don't remember.
Safe. And finally.
It actually was very early on, so I probably wouldn't remember.
Okay, well.
And that's a whole other story. You can mark that one and then ask me for the...
That's for episode 2. And your final song. Song you wish would have been your hit.
Oh, God, about a billion. I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
Shall I just make one up?
Yeah, make one up.
Almost any Beatles song.
Okay, perfect.
And anything from Pet Sounds.
Okay.
Well, which one? Are you going to make one up for me?
I was going to suggest Good Vibrations to put you on that road.
Oh, God.
Because that's that, in my opinion, is just about the perfect song.
It is. It makes me so jealous. Or envious, not jealous, just envious. I mean, it's such a, you know, all that stuff was so, and all those Beatles songs, just every single one of them was so well done, and craft that went into all of that stuff that we just talked about. I like production. I like anything that's got a bunch of vocal parts and, you know, just attention to detail. All those songs have the attention to detail and great stories. It's all good.
Well, they are all good. It's hard to name a bad Beatles song, but then I can say the same thing for Jan and Dean records. I love them all because they're fun, they're well-crafted, and they are memorable, and they take me straight back to... They're valid-sounding songs today, but they have the added bonus of feeding my nostalgia bend.
Well, that's very cool. Well, thank you. But, you know, it is in the production value and having, you know, the wrecking crew to be the players. So those recordings were, as you said, very well-crafted. So they can hold up. They don't sound really that old.
But I'm not giving all the credit to the Wrecking Crew. They certainly deserve a great deal. But I think you and Jan had a sound in your head and your ability to get that out onto microphones in the studio. That's a major talent right there.
Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. Don't be so humble. Well, listen, Dean, I'll let you go now. Part 2 coming up when I'm going to ask you questions about Jan Barry's crash. We're going to ask you about showering with James Brolin.
Ooh.
Yeah. You will answer that question, won't you?
Oh, God, yes.
Okay.
Don't let Barbara know.
Okay. I'm going to ask you, but there's a really cool song out there called Jingle Bell Rock with you and Mike Love. Want to find out about that. We're going to talk about Surf City. So much talk about. So much.
Okay.
Okay.
Part 2 will be coming your way.
Yes, we will keep both my listeners posted, okay?
Anytime, Dan. You obviously got the number, and feel free to call me at my little home office here.
With the broken Grammy,
with the book. I'll see if I can find it. I should try and get it back, I guess.
I hope it's not
in
some...
I can't remember who I gave it to.
It's not in some pawn shop somewhere. That's all I hope so.
That's a good question.
You know, and even if somebody...
I don't think it'd be worth that much, all broken and all
that. Yeah, but it's worth something to you, but they're going to have a hard time tracking you down because the name on it is spelled wrong.
Yeah, I know. They're going to look it up in the phone book, and it's not going to be there.
Well, my best to you and that charming family of yours, Dean. Thank you so much for the time today. It's always a pleasure talking with you, and we'll talk again in a few weeks, okay?
Look forward to it. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Dean, very much. Take care.
Aloha.
Aloha. Bye.
Bye.
I'm Dan Marcus. More interviews on the way, including part two of Dean Torrance, plus interviews with the late Rob Grill of the Grassroots, members of the Guess Who, Eric Burden of the Animals, and many more. Those are on the way. Please click follow or subscribe in order to get automatic notifications when I upload new material to the podcast. Also, there's a lot to hear and read and do at danmarcuswaxmuseum.com. And while you're at it, please find us on Facebook at Dan Marcus's Wax Museum. Once you find us, please like us and maybe share a couple of items with your friends. Thanks for your support of Dan Marcus's Wax Museum.